shakes with what I know is frustration. My mother is a fixer, and my life has turned into a tragedy she can't fix. "My sweet, sweet baby," she whispers into my hair. I untangle us, and she leads me into the foyer, where Dad and James stand in their pajamas. Dad swings an arm around my shoulders, while James sweeps Dave into an embrace worthy of a 3-month rather than 3-day separation. I see it, and a twinge of something unpleasant hits me in the solar plexus. Is this how it's going to be now? Bitterness and anger and jealousy every time I see another couple kiss? I swallow the feelings down and make a silent vow. My misery will not begrudge anyone, least of all Dave, his happiness. "Breakfast will be ready in 15 minutes, Mom says. I don't have the heart to tell her I just ate a rubbery egg and bagel sandwich on the plane. I snatch my bag from the floor where Dave dumped it and head up the stairs. "Just gonna grab a quick shower. If I'm not down by then, start without me." She gives me a worried nod. I haul my heavy body up the stairs and down the hallway to my bedroom, noticing that Mom has scoured the place. The woodwork gleams, the windows sparkle, even the linens have been laundered, and the beds made up, the corners tucked tighter than a hospital mattress. I dump everything on the foot end of mine and run a finger up the duvet, breathing in the heady scent of my favorite flower, stargazer lilies, stuffed into bowls and vases everywhere I look, on both nightstands, on the TV table, on the stool by the reading chair by the window. She must have spent a fortune. In the bathroom, the envelope sits like a hunk of kryptonite on my vanity. I inch my way across the tile and slide my shaking fingers into the padded paper, feeling around until they make contact with a cool slip of metal. I know it's Will's ring before I pull it out. I know it by the hammered finish, by the weight and the thickness of the metal, the way it slides up my thumb and hugs just the right spot between the joint and the base. My breath catches when I read the inscription, the tiny letters a jeweler in Buckhead overcharged me to hand engrave. My very favorite person, XO, Iris. A new wave of grief sucker punches me in the heart, a direct hit, and I settle the ring on my thumb, turn on the shower, and stumble in fully clothed. I think about the day I pushed it up Will's knobby finger, the ball of emotion that clogged my throat when we exchanged our vows, the way he twirled me around after until my heart felt like it would burst with joy. It was the perfect day, the first in the rest of our perfect lives together. How lucky was I to have found this man, my other half, my very favorite person, on a planet crammed with strangers. I knew that our love would last a lifetime. The lifetime lasted 7 years and a day. I tell myself I should be grateful, that I should cherish every second we had together. But as scalding water batters the top of my head, all I can think is more. Damn it, I wanted more. By the time I strip off my clothes and turn off the water, my skin has bloomed pink, my fingertips have shriveled white and wrinkly, and I've missed breakfast by a good half hour. I picture Mom downstairs in the kitchen, holding a plate of pancakes a foot thick and staring with longing up at the ceiling. I know I should go down there, but I can't. The inertia is as thick and sticky as flypaper. I leave my clothes in a wet heap on the shower floor, wrap my dripping body in a towel, and sink onto the vanity stool instead, inspecting my face in the mirror. Puffy eyes, dark circles, fish belly complexion, and sunken cheeks. It seems unfair that losing your husband means also losing your beauty. Haven't I lost enough? Haven't I been given enough shit to deal with? At the very least, widows should get rosy cheeks and glowing skin as a compensation prize. I'm reaching for my jar of moisturizer when my elbow jostles the Liberty Airlines envelope, revealing another one, a smaller one, lying beneath it. A plain number 10 envelope with a bluish tinge, generic and cheap. My name and address are typed in all caps across the front, under the words personal and confidential. I flip it over, poke a finger under the seal, and rip it open. The sheet of paper inside could have come from a million different notebooks, purchased at a million different stores. But it's the three little words, scrawled in a script as familiar to me as my own, that suck the air from my lungs. I'm so sorry. A burst of heat spreads across my chest. I snatch the envelope from the counter and check the postmark. The letter was sent 2 days ago, on April 8th. The crash happened on April 3rd. That's 5 days after the crash. After the crash. After it. And yet, this note was written by my husband's hand. I'm positive of it. The angular cursive, the lazy transitions, the too long tail on the last letter. Even the blots of ink are consistent with Will's favorite pen. There are a couple of hard knocks on the door, and Dave's voice carries around the corner. Iris, are you decent? It takes me a couple of tries to find my voice. Come in. My brother's face appears above me in the mirror, his concerned gaze lasering in on mine.
Was it his?
At first I think he means the note, even though I just opened it, and there's no possible way he could know. Huh?
The ring. I take it it was Will's?
Oh, right, the ring. I wiggle my thumb, feel the hard metal pushing against my skin. Yes, it's his.
Oh, Jesus. I'm so sorry, Iris. I was hoping.
Dave steps closer, resting a supportive hand on my still damp shoulder.
I know you were hoping, too.
It's all I can do to nod. He gives me a funny look, and I pass him the paper over my shoulder.
What's this?
A note. My voice is shaky, and so is my body. The emotions coursing through me so fast, my muscles vibrate with it. I think Will wrote it.
Okay.
Dave dips his head, his eyes scanning the paper.
Sorry about what?
I don't know. I hand him the envelope, let him do the math for himself. It doesn't take him long. He spots the postmark, and his head whips up, his eyes blowing wide.
Who sent you this?
I shrug. It's postmarked Fulton County, which means it's local. Dave sputters for a few seconds before his anger catches wind.
Is this some kind of sick joke?
He shakes the paper above my head, his face turning purple with fury.
This is psychotic. Whoever sent you a note from your dead husband is a psychopath. You know that, right?
I nod. But it's definitely Will's handwriting.
It's postmarked 2 days ago,
he roars, scowling at my reflection as if I'm the one who dropped it in an Atlanta mailbox.
How could Will have written it?
He must have done it before he died.
Then who sent it?
Dave's anger ignites my own.
I don't know,
I scream back, the words fueled by fury and frustration. My skin is blistered with it, with the shock of receiving a note in my dead husband's scrawl. The bathroom plunges into silence. Behind me, Dave sucks a lungful of air and blows it all out, long and slow, until his shoulders unhunch and his expression loses some of its heat.
Sorry. Sorry, but I'm pissed, okay? I'm going into Big Brother protective mode, because whoever sent you this did so with one intent, and one intent only, and that's to fuck with your head.
I let out a laugh that's not the least bit funny. Don't tell him, but it's working. Another hard sigh.
Okay, let's back up and think this through. I'm so sorry is generic enough. He could have said it to anyone, but to write it on a piece of paper and hand it to them, it has to be someone he knew pretty well, Someone he worked with, maybe?
Probably the most likely candidate. If Will wasn't home, he was at the office. Either there or at the The word gets swallowed up in a realization, and I twist around on my stool, staring at Dave head on. Corbin.
Who?
The friend from the gym? The one who showed up at the memorial with news of the job that wasn't. I don't know if he was lying or misinformed, but there was something off about him. Mostly because he knew all these things about Will, when I'd never heard of this guy. Will never talked about him at all. Not once.
Okay.
Dave nods.
Definitely suspicious. So, how do we find out if he's the one?
I pause to think, but the answer doesn't take me long. I'll call him. Ask him to meet me for coffee. Get to know him a little better.
Maybe you didn't hear me just now. I said we. How do we find out?
I shake my head. He won't open up if he suspects even for a second we're on to him, which he will if I bring along a chaperone. I'm a psychologist, Dave. I know how to make people flip over and show me their underbelly. But I have to build trust first, and I can't do that with you glaring at him over my shoulder.
I don't like it.
The anger is back in his voice, and it's laced with, oh, hell no.
If he's our guy...
If he's our guy, then having you there will make him clam up for sure. Give me a little credit. I'm not stupid. I'll make sure to suggest a public place, a spot with a million people around. Nothing will happen. I'll be fine. And no offense, but nothing you can say is going to stop me. My brother thinks about it for a second or two, puffing a trio of short and quick breaths through his nose.
Fine, but... Only if you promise me that if he's our guy, you'll let me kick his ass.
I don't tell him there's not a chance, that Corbin is built like a tank. I don't remind him of that time in 10th grade when the PE coach told Dave he fights like a girl. Instead, I nod and reach for his hand, thinking, never have I loved my brother more. Chapter 18. Corbin is seated on a bar stool by the window at Octane, a trendy coffee bar and lounge on Atlanta's west side, when I walk through the door. The place is packed with new-age nerds and long-haired hipsters, interspersed with a few grad students from the downtown colleges, all of them pounding away at their MacBook Airs. Corbin looks up from his phone, greeting me with a smile that is both quick and blinding.
Hey, Iris.
I toss him a wave, then gesture to the counter. Can I get you anything? He lifts a ceramic mug from the bar top, fresh steam rising from the rim.
I'm all good, thanks.
I head to the counter, reciting my order to a dreadlocked girl, and study him out of the corner of my eye. I'd forgotten how dark and shiny he is. His scalp is cleanly shaven and buffed to a high sheen. His arms slick and smooth, where they bulge out of his sleeves. I also can't help but notice he's handsome. The kind of handsome that comes with glossy magazine covers and red carpet appearances. His clothes are casual, a fitted t-shirt and designer jeans, but he wears them with the elegance of a custom suit, perfect for his lean frame. I was too wrecked the day of the memorial to pay much attention to his looks, but I'm noticing them now. And I'm not the only one. Judging from the hair twirls and liquid looks over coffee cup rims, every female in the place has spotted him and is trying to snag his attention. Their doe eyes narrow when they get a load of me heading in his direction. I drop my drink on the bar and let him pull me into a hug, soft cotton over muscles hard as steel. He smells like detergent and aftershave, a spicy scent that tickles the back of my throat.
So great to see you again. How are you holding up?
Friendly, empathetic, sincere. If this guy's behind the letter, if he's capable of torturing a widow with a handwritten note from her dead husband, he's an Oscar-worthy actor, skilled at hiding behind his charm. This doesn't mean I'm letting my guard down. There are plenty of good actors out there, not all of them in Hollywood. I sink onto a stool, hanging my bag from a hook under the bar. As well as can be expected, I guess. Thanks for meeting me, and for bringing over the box of Will's stuff. I especially liked the picture CD. Most were images I'd seen before on Will's phone or on Facebook, but there were a few new shots, candids with Corbin surrounded by others at the gym, their faces shiny with sweat, their arms slung around each other's shoulders. Their easy smiles and relaxed postures told me their friendship extended beyond occasional workouts, and seeing them made the hurt throb all over again in my chest. Why did Will keep that part of his life secret from me?
Will was a good friend. The best,
Corbin says, his voice and expression mournful, more points in his favor.
I already miss him like hell.
Me too. I swallow down the sudden lump in my throat, scolding myself for letting him get me choked up. No way I'm going to let him play me like that. Not until I know for certain he didn't send me that note. I curl a hand around my teacup, threading a finger through the handle, and pull myself together.
The paper said they've begun recovering bodies from the crash site and have already returned some personal items to the families.
I nod, my free hand floating to the spot where Will's ring hangs from a chain, right above my heart, my emotions skidding into dangerous territory, my eyes filling, damn it, with tears.
Jeez, Iris, I can't even begin to imagine how hard that must be for you.
He wraps a palm around my elbow, gives it a quick squeeze.
I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry. The exact same words on Will's note. Even though the words are generic, the match dries my eyes like a blast of icy air, and they narrow into a squint I bury in my teacup. Was it intentional? A fluke? The idea that this man would send me that note, then taunt me by saying the identical words to my face, burrows like an insect under my skin. I gulp at my tea, but the hot liquid only fans the flames in my belly. Could Corbin really be that cruel? Could anyone?
Are you okay?
His concern, as genuine as it sounds, tells me I need to get a hold of myself, of this conversation. I wipe my expression clean and drop my cup back onto the saucer. I'm fine, but I asked you here because I wanted to get your take on something. I pause to receive his nod. I called ESP, the company you told me offered Will a new job. I talked to their head of HR. She didn't know Will. And what's more, she told me the last executive job was filled over 8 months ago.
I don't.
Corbin's gaze doesn't let mine go, but his dark brows, along with his lashes, the only hairs on his head, dip in a sharp V.
You're telling me that Will didn't get a new job in Seattle?
That's right.
But I don't get it. Why would he feed me that elaborate story about a new job on the West Coast if it wasn't true? Why would he tell me about these hotshot new colleagues he was going to have? All the cool and crazy things they did on their team-building excursions.
He told me they were taking him skydiving,
and that their office building had a zip line. I mean, those are some pretty specific details. Why would he make all that up?
He didn't make it up. I'm pretty sure he got it from ESP's website.
But the new job, the move to the West Coast, his worries you wouldn't want to leave your family. That was all fabrication?
Apparently so. Corbin's frown deepens, and his eyes flash with something I recognize as disappointment. His friend, the one he misses like hell, lied to him. He seems so genuinely offended that I decide to switch tracks. Did Will ever tell you where he was from? Corbin tries to shake it off, crossing a denim-clad leg and bouncing his red Converse sneaker under the bar.
Oh, sure. I have a couple of cousins in Memphis, so Will and I were always comparing notes. Turns out we've been to a bunch of the same neighborhood haunts.
Will is from Seattle.
Okay.
Corbin drags out the word like he's humoring me, but his legs go still.
But then he moved to Memphis when he was what, 5, 6? I know for sure it was when he was still a kid. Will went to Central, the big rival of the school where my cousins went.
Will went to Hancock High in Seattle. For the longest moment, Corbin is speechless. A lapse of silence that amplifies the coffee shop sounds all around us. His face goes slack, like he's running headlong into a door.
Are you sure?
Positive. I have the yearbook to prove it.
So, okay. That's...
He runs a palm over his shiny scalp, and I can see his mind working, trying to puzzle the pieces together. That he can't make them fit seems to have him baffled.
Sorry, but I have to ask, why all the lies?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. But if it makes you feel any better, he told them to me, too. His head tilts.
You thought he was from Memphis, too?
Yes.
Then how'd you find out about Seattle?
I don't see any reason not to tell him, though I do keep my answer as vague as possible. I received a condolence card from Hancock, class of 1999. One thing led to another. He takes that in with a curt nod, then falls still for a long moment.
Okay, so on the one hand, I'm more confused than ever. But on the other, in some weird, twisted way, things sort of make sense.
What are you talking about?
Will's behavior lately. He just seemed so distracted and, I don't know, off. Moody and super stressed out. A couple of weeks ago, some guy at the gym told him to wipe down the machine, and Will just lost it. He started screaming and throwing punches, and I had to physically drag him outside and calm him down. I've never seen him lose his temper like that. Now I'm wondering if one thing had to do with the other. Like, if he was acting funny because of all the lies, or if the lies were to cover up something else. Does that make any sense?
A flurry of emotions rise in my chest, a familiar hurt leading the pack. It makes total sense, unfortunately.
Was he acting stressed with you, too?
Events from the past month flash across my mind like a slideshow. The time I was making dinner while he paced the backyard, his cell pressed to his ear and his face clamped down in a scowl, talking to a person he would identify only as a colleague. The time I came downstairs to him sitting in his car in the driveway, staring into space for a good 20 minutes. The time I rolled over to find him wide awake, watching me with an expression I'd never seen before, an emotion I couldn't define. When I asked him what was wrong, his answer was to make love to me. But APSEC had just acquired the city of Atlanta as a client, and Will's team was working under a tight deadline. He brushed his behavior off as work stress, and at the time, I believed him. Or maybe I just wanted to. Now, though? Now I'm certain there was something else going on, something that made Will get on a plane to Seattle.
You knew him better than anyone else, Corbin says. What do you think was going on?
I roll his question around my mind for a long moment, coming at it from every possible angle. I think about Will's sketchy past, the destruction he left in his wake back in Seattle, the deadly fire that burned down a block of apartments and landed Will's mother and 2 innocent children in early graves. His father, alone and bedridden in a state facility for the indigent. And these are only the people I know about. How many others are there? I swish around the last of my tea, watching the dregs swirl around the bottom of my cup. I think something, or more likely someone, from his past came back to haunt him. I think that's why he was acting strange, and why he got on a plane to Seattle. Corbin doesn't answer. I look up, and he's gone completely still. What?
I wasn't going to tell you this, but based on that answer, I feel like I have to.
He pauses, holding my gaze with eyes so black I can't tell his pupil from his iris.
A day or two before the crash, Will called to ask me for a favor. He made me swear on my mother's grave that I would do it.
He stops, and so does my heart. That you'd do what?
I promised that if anything ever happened to him, I'd look out for you.
I return home to a mountain of Lowe's bags climbing the walls of my foyer, and my father on his knees, a drill in his hand and a tool belt slung around his waist. What's going on?
Floodlights at both doors. That's what's going on.
He roots around in one of the bags, pulls out a handful of light switches.
I'll mount these guys on the inside wall, but the outdoor fixtures have motion sensors. Anybody who gets within 5 feet will find themselves in the spotlight. Literally.
Is this because of the letter?
The letter, the text, and the fact that you live smack in the middle of the 12th most dangerous city in the country. I'm also changing your locks and putting in extra deadbolts and chains. And an alarm company is coming by later today to hook your system up to their central monitoring system.
Mom comes in from the living room, a book tucked under her arm. I also asked him to fix the sticky front door, reattach that loose floorboard by the kitchen table, and replace that rubber thingy on the leaky hall toilet.
Valve,
Dad says, pushing to his feet.
She asked me to replace the rubber valve. I got enough to replace all of them. You'll thank me when you get your next water bill.
I'll thank you now, too, I say, and it comes out only a little wobbly, even though what I really want to do is have a good cry that Will never got through his honey-do list. What were the last two that he added? Our last morning together in bed? It takes me a second or two to come up with them. The filters on the air conditioners, and the oil in my car. I resolve to take care of those myself. My father bends his knees, putting his eyes on the level of mine.
If you're worried about the costs, Pumpkin, your mother and I will foot the bill. We'd just feel better if you were safe and secure and hooked up to some kind of system. Especially now.
I know what he was going to say, especially now that Will's gone. He looks so distraught, not to mention worried, that I wrap my arms around his waist and pull him tight, fresh tears gathering in my own eyes. Now that I'll be living here all alone, I'd feel better with a working alarm, too. Thank you, but I don't want you to pay.
Settled, then.
Dad drops a kiss on the top of my head and unwinds us, fishing the drill from where he'd left it in the pile of bags. He hits the button, buzzing the blade around in the air, then takes his finger off the trigger.
Almost forgot. Will's boss left another message while you were gone. By now, he's 5th or 6th. I take it you haven't found a chance to call him back yet.
I shake my head. Ever since Will's ring, I haven't given Nick or any of the other callers a second thought.
You might want to make him a priority, Pumpkin. I'd imagine he has some financial and logistical issues to discuss, things you won't want to wait too long to tackle. I know it's unpleasant, but you've got a mortgage to pay, and you're going to have to figure out how to do it on one salary.
Come. Mom slips her hand into my elbow and leads me down the hall. You call this Nick person, and I'll fix us some tea. Oh, and I have brownies, too, if the boys didn't eat them all. I look around for Dave and James. Where are they?
They ran to the post office.
Dave said something about a yearbook he needed to mail, and then to meet up with an old friend of James's from med school. Apparently, he sold his practice for the jackpot and now owns a gourmet burger place on Peachtree Street. $17 for a hamburger. Can you imagine? Anyway, is Earl Grey okay? Perfect, thanks. But Mom doesn't go for the tea bags. She just stands there, watching me. What?
Well, I was wondering if you've given any thought to a funeral. One that's maybe a little more personal than the memorial service Liberty Air put on. That one was perfectly fine, but it didn't really feel like Will, you know? It could have been for anyone. I nod, because she's right. Despite the pretty setting, the memorial had zero personality. The songs were cheesy, the speakers were unimaginative, and the only time they mentioned my husband by name was during a monotonous reading of the passenger list. Will deserves better than a generic memorial service in a park filled with strangers. Want me to come up with some options? Mom offers. Take a look at some venues? I wouldn't book anything, of course, not until you approve it. I smile, a fierce wave of love for my mother warming my insides. Thank you. I'd really appreciate that. Good. It's settled then. Now, you go call this Nick fellow back. His number's on a sticky by the coffee machine. While Mom bangs away in the kitchen, I fetch the sticky note, punch the numbers into my cell phone, and push send. Nick picks up on the second ring.
Nick Brackman.
Hi, Nick. It's Iris Griffith. Sorry for not calling back earlier, but things have been a little crazy.
I'll bet. How are you holding up?
It's the same question strangers recited to me at the memorial, the one I see every time I look into my parents' eyes. Word for word, the one Corbin said to me earlier today. How are you holding up? I know they mean well, but does Nick really want to hear that I still sleep in Will's bathrobe, even though it smells more like me now? Or that I call Will's voicemail 20 times a day, just so I can hear his voice? That my tears wake me most nights, which are only marginally better than the ones where fury makes me scream into my pillow? That the platitudes everybody keeps feeding me, things like, everything happens for a reason, and Will would want you to be happy, make me want to punch something? That sometimes I feel Will so strongly, the air catches in my throat, and the hairs soldier up the back of my neck, but when I turn, the only thing I find is the hole where he used to be. I sigh, collapse onto the couch, and tell Nick what he wants to hear. I'm okay. The only thing worse than Nick's question, I suppose, will be the day people stop asking it.
Glad to hear it. If there's anything I can do.
Another platitude, and I bite down on a scream. Thanks.
Jessica's boxed up his personal things from the office. It wasn't much. A couple of books, some mugs, a few framed pictures.
I think she was planning to swing by with it this weekend. Surely this isn't what he called to tell me. Meaningless cliches and organizational logistics. I give him a curt hum of thanks, a not-so-gentle prompt for his next words. Either Nick gets tired of stalling, or he takes my bait.
Listen, I have something I need to talk to you about, and I'd really rather not do it over the phone. Do you think we could meet? You name the time and place, and I'll make it work.
Well, I just got home, and
you live in Inman Park, right?
I don't answer. Nick knows I live in Inman Park. Our address is on the salary stubs he signs every month.
How about Inman Park in an hour? Best coffee in town. My treat.
After my morning with Corbin, I can't contemplate another coffee shop. And after the past few days, cooped up either in a hotel room, a car, or on a plane, I can't contemplate another second indoors. I'll meet you at Inman Park, but do you mind if we walk the Beltline? I could use a little fresh air.
Done. Thanks, Iris. See you in an hour.
As I head out the door to meet Nick, I punch in the number Dad gave me for Leslie Thomas. She picks up on the second ring.
Before you say a word, she says by way of greeting, I want to apologize for lying to you the first time I called. I was under an unbelievable amount of pressure to come back with a story. I've only been here a few months, and this was my first chance to prove myself, and I took it too far.
And now? My voice is hard, because I don't forgive her. The edges of my anger are still sharp. This woman dangled the name of a cocktail waitress in front of my nose like a carrot. I'm not exactly calling her by choice. And now what? I sink onto my front stoop, squinting into the sunshine. Are you still under an unbelievable amount of pressure to come back with a story now? She laughs, but it comes across more ironic than funny. Well, my boss just suggested I pose as another passenger's sister, so you tell me. I make a neutral sound. This woman lied to me once. Who's to say she won't do it again? Listen, all I'm saying is that I feel really shitty for lying, and I want to make it up to you. Throw you the proverbial bone. Let me guess. The cocktail waitress's name. Ex-waitress, actually. It's Tiffany Rivero, and she served a certain pilot and his rowdy buddies until they cashed out at 2:45 the morning of the crash, and for over $6,000. My eyes blow wide, both at her message and the amount. People spend $6,000 at a nightclub? They do when they're chugging champagne like it's lemonade, which these guys apparently were. There were also pills being passed around like Tic Tacs. I suck in a breath, doing the math in my head, assuming he got the first flight to Atlanta, probably around 6 or so. He would have gone straight to the airport, meaning he was functioning on virtually no sleep, and that's not even taking into account whatever he consumed. We can't know for sure that the pilot was partaking. According to Tiffany, he was. Every single one of them was wasted. And here's the kicker. Everything she told me, she also told Liberty Air officials. Their response? That she must be mistaken. That there are procedures and protocols in place to make sure no pilot enters the cockpit unless 100% sober and alert. They tried to make her think she'd imagined it. An icy cold blooms in my gut, spreading through it like a cancer. Liberty Air knows about the pilot's alcohol and drug-fueled bachelor party, and they did nothing. They said nothing. I think about the families I saw at the airport and at the memorial, of their tears and palpable grief, and a wave of helpless fury threatens to pull me under. Will is dead because of a pilot's irresponsibility and an airline's carelessness. Why are you telling me this? I assume this story is about to be blown across every front page of every newspaper and website on the planet. True, but my guilty conscience and I wanted you to hear it here first and to make sure you understood the implications. She pauses, the silence short but weighted, and her jokey tone settles into a serious one. There's going to be an investigation, Iris, and if this Tiffany chick is legit, if what she says checks out, you and the other families will have Liberty Air by the balls. Chapter 19. When I turn the corner to Inman Park, Nick is standing on the sidewalk. Two water bottles dangling from a fist. White blonde hair, supersized limbs, doughy belly filling out the bottom of his tucked-in polo shirt like a half-inflated inner tube. I must have been worse off than I thought when I couldn't place him at the memorial. Big and bulky, he's not exactly the type of guy you can miss. A pair of pristine Nike sneakers poke out from under his office khakis. From the looks of them, fresh from a shoebox. And I'm suddenly sorry for suggesting we walk the belt line in the middle of a work day. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Iris. Thanks for meeting me. You ready?
I try to take his emotional pulse, but his eyes are hidden behind dark wraparound sunglasses, his tone and expression guarded. Ready as I'll ever be. The thing is, by now I know that whatever Nick wanted to talk to me about, it can't be good. Why else would he have called 6 times in half as many days and insisted we meet in person? If I had any doubts, his greeting and body language just now only confirmed it, morphing my suspicion into a dread as dark and sticky as tar. He passes me one of the bottles, ice cold and sweating, and we set off for the alley that leads to the trail in painful, stomach-churning silence. Like on any other spring day, the Atlanta Beltline, a stretch of parks and trails carved out of the city's abandoned railroad tracks, is bustling. Lululemon-clad moms pushing strollers compete for space with runners and dog walkers and college kids on skateboards. Nick and I fall in line behind them, following the trail north toward the high-rises of Midtown in the far distance.
"This is incredibly difficult for me," he says, as we emerge from the shade of the Freedom Parkway overpass,
and even though he's starting to sweat through his work shirt, I know he's not referring to our hike. His head is down, his gaze glued to the pavement.
"I hired your husband. I groomed him. In the 8+ years he worked for me, I promoted him 6 times. Not because I liked the guy, which I did, but because he deserved it."
"Okay." I drag out the word, my heart jumping around too hard, too fast. I feel a butt coming. It's bearing down on me like an electric thundercloud, sucking every hair on my body skyward.
"I don't know how much you know about our business, but most engineers don't give a crap about where the money comes from. Will was one of those rare breeds that not only cared, he thought about how to bring in more. It's part of why he was so brilliant at his job, because he could design things the customer didn't even know they wanted until he showed it to them."
He latches onto my elbow, steers us to the trail's edge to let a trio of bicyclists pass.
"The guy was a genius, but I'm sure you already know that."
"I do."
"It's part of the reason why it took us so long. Will was the last person we suspected, the one we never saw coming."
His words squirm under my skin. At the same time, frustration burns across my chest, and I can no longer bite down on my impatience.
"Sorry, Nick, but I slept on a plane last night, and that's after 7 nights of hardly any sleep at all. I'm wrecked and exhausted, so please, can you cut the crap and tell me what you came here to tell me?"
He stops in the middle of the trail, turning his big body to face mine.
"There's some money missing from our corporate accounts."
An icy fist hits me in the center of the chest and spreads outward as, suddenly, all the pieces fall together and everything makes sense. It's like one of those psychological tests I give to my students, where you get the gist of the sentence, even though most of the words are missing. In this case, the words are, "Your husband is a thief." I fold my arms over my chest, shivering despite the temperature nudging up into the low 70s.
"How much money?"
He bounces his meaty shoulders.
"Hard to tell, exactly. The forensic accountant is still..."
"Forensic accountant?"
The words travel down me like a lightning bolt, melting my rubber soles to the pavement.
"I'm no finance whiz, but I know the term.
Lake Forest divorces almost always include one, a financial investigator specialized in ferreting out hidden funds. Last year, Jeanette Davis's mother was awarded half of her soon-to-be ex-husband's offshore accounts, thanks to hers."
"As I was saying, until the forensic accountant comes back with her final report, we don't have a number."
"Give me a ballpark."
$4,473,000.
Nick coughs into a fist.
"And counting."
"So, what you're really asking me here is if I've happened to notice an extra $4.5 million sitting around our joint bank account?"
The words feel like okra, prickly and slimy on my tongue.
"No, but..." Nick grimaces. "I thought maybe you might know something."
My eyes widen.
"No! Jesus, no! Of course not!"
"My ass is on the line here, Iris. We're planning to go public next year, and my board is holding me accountable. Nobody wants to buy stock in a company whose internal procedures allow an employee to walk away with $4.5 million. Please, if there's anything you're not telling me..."
"He didn't walk away, Nick. He got on a plane that fell out of the sky."
I think about what Leslie Thomas told me, of a hungover pilot half asleep at the wheel, and a surge of sick rises from my belly. He winces.
I know that, and I'm sorry as hell about it. But what I'm trying to say here is, I thought of Will as a friend, which is partially why I'd like to keep this between us.
Meaning?
Meaning that if we get back that money and can straighten out the books, that will be the end of it. It'll stay between us. No questions asked. At this point, I don't care about the whys and hows. I just need to recover the money.
You really think I know where it is? He gives me an apologetic smile, but it doesn't soften his next words.
Do you?
Anger rises up inside me, silent and swift.
You can't seriously be asking me that.
His silence tells me he is. I'm suddenly nauseous. Too much tea and Mom's brownie revolting in my gut, and I worry I might throw up on Nick's brand new sneakers.
I'm sure it's all a big misunderstanding.
Nick shakes his head, short and definitive.
It's not.
How do you know that Will's the one who took it?
I can't tell you that.
$4.5 million doesn't just disappear overnight. This must have been going on for years. How does nobody not notice?
I can't tell you that, either. In fact, I've probably said too much already. My lawyers are going to have a shit fit when I tell them about this conversation.
Lawyers. Forensic accountants. I roll the Cartier ring up and down my finger with my thumb, an unconscious habit I picked up sometime this past week, fiddling with the ring whenever I think of Will. Maybe it's because of the way he gave it to me, so unexpectedly and intimately. Or maybe it's because of his words, you, me, and baby-to-be. But for some reason, for lots of reasons, touching it has given me comfort. Until now. Now I notice Nick noticing, and jutting out above his dark shades, there's a new crease between his brows. I shove my fists into the pockets of my hoodie. I don't know anything about the money, and I can assure you it's not sitting in our account. For the longest time, he doesn't respond. People pass us on all sides, whizzing by on skates and skateboards, and Nick just stands there, filling up half the path with his girth and watching me with a blank expression. I know what he's doing. He's waiting for me to insist it's not true, that his forensic accountant must have made a mistake, that Will Griffith wasn't capable of stealing from him or from anyone. But I can't seem to choke the words out. If my husband was the type of person to once upon a time set fire to an apartment complex filled with sleeping people, who's to say he wouldn't swipe some cash from his employer's account? I stand there across from him, biting down on my tongue and a mounting urge to cry. Nick takes my silence as the answer it is, giving me a sorry smile before heading back the way we came.
Sorry, Iris. But I'm going after that money, even if that means taking you and a dead man down in the process.
As soon as Nick's gone, I toss the water bottle into a trash can and take off running. It's a gorgeous spring afternoon, and the air is filled with the sounds of a sunny day in the city. Leaf blowers buzzing, the musical jangle of dogs on leashes, the low thrum of traffic in the distance, and the resounding slap of my sneakers against the pavement. 8 days of little food and no activity has my muscles weak and stiff, and every step feels like punishment. But Nick's words are chasing me, and I need to burn off all the nervous energy twitching in my bones. Will and I loved the Beltline. We loved the urban artwork and the skyline views and the miles and miles of parks and green space. We loved exploring it on our matching bikes, old-school types with three gears, metal bells, and wicker baskets hanging from the handlebars. Will surprised me with them 1 year for my birthday.
You know what this means, right? I said, climbing on mine and wheeling it up and down the street with a loud whoop.
Will grinned from where he was watching, his hands on his hips, at the top of the drive.
No more Uber bills?
I laughed. That, plus if we bike all the way to Midtown and back, the French fries I'm going to eat for lunch will be guilt-free. We took the bikes out whenever we could, on sunny weekends and warm evenings, to restaurants and bars, and just because. And we were that obnoxious couple who took up the entire Beltline because we biked back holding hands. And now, if I'm to believe everything I've learned today, this same man was a criminal, a liar and a thief, one who in the last month of his life was distracted and moody, one who got into fights at the gym and punched dents into living room walls, one who Nick and his forensic accountant were on to. It doesn't take a genius to figure out Will was probably feeling squeezed. I sprint past cell towers and graffitied walls, along townhomes and parks and restaurants, their terraces filling with an early happy hour crowd. The sun's rays beat down on my head, and I pull over on the side of the trail to peel off my hoodie. As I'm tying it around my waist, the Cartier ring blinks in the golden light. When I was flipping through our bank statements last week, did I see a line item for Cartier? I squeeze my eyes and try to remember. Surely I would have noticed that kind of charge. Designer diamonds don't come cheap. I dig my phone from a zippered pocket, check both my banking and credit card apps. No big ticket items on any of them. No $4.5 million either. So, how did Will pay for this ring? The question starts a dull throb behind my breastbone, and I turn back for my car. The Cartier store is smack in the middle of the Neiman Marcus wing at Lenox Square, nestled between other high-end brands. I hurry down the broad hallway, past Tesla and Louis Vuitton and Prada, wishing I'd made time to change out of my running clothes, maybe do something with my hair. A uniformed security guard is stationed behind Cartier's heavy glass door. He takes me in through the window with an, "Are you sure you're in the right place?" stare. I lift my chin and reach for the brass handle, and he jerks forward before my fingers can make contact.
"Good morning, ma'am,"
he says, whisking open the door.
"Welcome to Cartier."
The place screams expensive. Dark wood paneling, plush carpet, glittering jewels floating behind displays of seamless glass. The floral arrangements alone probably cost as much as my monthly electricity bill. Standing among them puts me on edge, like anyone here can see that I'm not one of them, an imposter. I look around, but other than the security guard and a blonde sales clerk polishing a gold bangle bracelet with a deep red cloth, the store is empty. She looks up with a generic smile.
"Can I help you?"
Her accent is heavy and Russian, and she has every cliché you've ever heard about Eastern European mail-order brides. Tall and thin, bleached blonde hair, a few spritzes more than necessary of perfume. Her nails are too long, and her makeup is too shiny, and her generous curves are stuffed into a too short, too tight suit. She's strikingly pretty, though, even if she doesn't exactly exude warmth. My gaze dips to her name tag. "Hi, Natasha. My husband was in here recently and bought me this." I held up my right hand, and her brows rise infinitesimally. Suppressed surprise, or Botox, or a combination of the two.
"I was wondering if you could look up the details of the sale."
"Is gift, no?"
"Yes."
"You don't like?"
"No, I love. I hold out my hand, gazing down at the three thick bands of gold and diamonds. "I just what?
Suspect my husband bought it with stolen money? Think the receipt might hold a clue as to where he stashed the rest of the $4.5 million?
"I need the papers for insurance purposes."
"Ah, of course,"
she says. She settles the bracelet back in the case, locks it, and slips the key into a jacket pocket, then gestures for me to follow her to an ornate cherry desk along the right wall.
"Please, have a seat."
I sink onto the padded chair across from her.
"What is husband's name?"
She pulls a wireless keyboard from a drawer, twisting to face the computer screen.
"William Griffith.
He would have been in here 2 or 3 weeks ago, I'm guessing. Recognition alights on her face, an almost smile.
Lucky you. Handsome man.
You remember him?
I sold him ring.
I try to picture my husband hunched over the shiny cases, his brow furrowed in frustration, while busty Natasha helps him select the perfect gift. Eye candy aside, he's never been much of a shopper, and he's always detested the mall.
Why fight the crowds? He always said. Everything I could ever need can be bought on the internet and shipped to my front door.
Your husband did homework. He knew which ring, what size. Quickest sale I ever make.
I take in her words, thinking her scenario makes much more sense. Of course he would have scoured their website before coming, would have even called ahead to make sure they had the ring in stock. They probably had Natasha here, waiting at the door with the bag and the credit card machine. Get in, get out, get on with his day. She punches a button on the keyboard, and the printer whirs to life.
Had money to exact penny.
I give her a pleasant nod, then freeze when her words sink in. Wait a minute. Are you telling me he paid for the ring in cash? She glances over, but only long enough to dip her chin.
Duh. How much cash?
$12,400, plus tax.
She says it as easily as if she's rattling off the price for a pound of sugar. Well, I try to come up with something I own that costs that much money. A heavily mortgaged house, a bank loan for a 4-year-old car. Not even my engagement diamond, a simple solitaire set in platinum prongs, was that expensive. The infinity ring suddenly feels too tight, like 3 rubber bands stretched to snapping around the base of my finger.
$12,400? Plus tax.
She takes the papers from the printer and presses it into a red leather booklet, checking a number on the screen.
$13,268.
With or without tax, the amount is staggering. I watch the receipt roll off the printer and wonder if he bought anything that day besides the ring. If the $4.5 million was burning a hole in his pocket. How was he planning to hide that kind of cash? Where did he hide that kind of cash? Would it fit in a box under the floorboards? In a safe up in the attic? Or would he need one of those fireproof storage units advertised on billboards along the downtown connector? And most important, how would I go about finding it? The sales clerk slides the booklet across the desk.
Tell husband Natasha says hi.
Chapter 20. Back in my idling car, I open the red leather booklet and flip through the papers Natasha pressed into it. A certificate of authenticity for the ring, the return policy, an invoice and tax receipt. I run the pad of my finger over Will's familiar signature, scrawled across the bottom, swallowing a sudden lump. Will may have bought this ring with stolen money, but that doesn't change the fact he bought it from me. He braved the mall and selected a gift that would mean something for me, for us. Pink for love, yellow for fidelity, white for friendship. Him, me, and baby to be. No matter his past, no matter where he got the money and how he paid for it, this ring is mine. I'll never take it off. And then my gaze falls on the contact information on the invoice. Below Will's name, below our home address, there's a phone number I don't recognize. It's one of the 3 Atlanta area codes, 678, but the digits are otherwise unfamiliar. Definitely not Will's cell, which begins with 404. His work number, maybe? Will was always calling me from numbers I didn't recognize, and he said the only ones I should ever bother to save were his cell, Jessica's direct line, and the main number for AppSec. Now I wish I'd been more meticulous about recording them. I pull up his contact page on my phone,
check the numbers I have for his office against the Cartier receipt. None of them match. So, what? Natasha got the number wrong when she entered it into the system? Will gave her a fake number to avoid being at the receiving end of the store's telemarketing campaign?